Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We have a fun show for you today that includes Rwandan comedian Oliver Twist talking about his life and career. We have Rove McManus swinging by to discuss the penultimate episode of WandaVision. And then I try to rave about Ryan Hughes' book, XX, A Novel Graphic, without giving anything away. My name is Justin Hamilton, and you're part of a worldwide conspiracy called Big Squid. Before we get into the podcast properly, I feel like I should just give you a heads up as to some stuff that's happening. If you're free on the 11th of March in Wodonga or the 12th of March in Canberra, I will be travelling with the Sydney Comedy Festival Tour to perform as part of their lineups. Usually a lot of fun. I don't know who I'm on with at this point, but it's quite usually an eclectic range of acts, so you'll get a broader sense of who was around the scene and who's performing where. And that's what I love about it. I love that you can get someone who is a young inner city comic, and then you might get someone who lives in the outer burbs, and you might get someone older and someone who's younger. They're fun gigs, so if you're keen and you're in those areas, I would head to the Sydney Comedy Festival website and you will be able to find more details there. Just so you know what's going on with this podcast, I've just finished watching and writing a script for our next Sofia Coppola series. So Ben and I will be recording that soon, hopefully. We're just trying to make our schedules line up. And coming up over the next few weeks are interviews with Dave Anthony, Alice Fraser, AJ Lamar. I don't know if you've met him before, but he's great. I actually recorded that podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I'm chomping at the bit to get it up. Rachel Melanta has a really funny segment about snails. I know, you're thinking, what is that about? Trust me, it all makes sense. Well, kind of makes sense when Rachel talks about it. And my friend Garth Jones, he has a new Ozploitation segment that we're working on. And we've got some good stuff coming your way. So I'm really looking forward to bringing all of that to your ears, I guess. I've also been talking to an audio producer friend of mine, Andy, who worked with me on The Ballad of John Tildanimus. Anyone who saw those shows knows the soundscapes we created. And we're getting ready to produce something new for you that is coming along very soon. I know I keep saying that. I keep saying very soon. It's just been a weird year where there was everything just keeps moving. So every time I think, right, I can get this done, something pops up. Not a complaint. There was heaps of free time last year, and that was weird. So I'm happy to be busy. It's just trying to get a head around how this moving schedule keeps changing shape and form. But we will get there, and this work is getting to be produced very soon. And then on the 25th of April, we will be returning with a new live Big Squid at Giant Dwarf, which you can once again stream online or come to the venue to watch. Our topic for this show is, can we still enjoy it? And I'll have a blend of returning guests and brand new friends who will be joining us on that stage. I'm sure this is going to be a very interesting and potentially controversial show, and will probably have me weeping at some point at all the stuff I just can't get behind anymore. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure those of you who have followed me for a while or know me personally probably know what I'm going to lean into at the start. So pencil that in your diary. It'll be a great show. The people that I already have booked are fantastic. And I'll give you more details as to when we're on sale for that. Right. Let's get into the podcast and begin with XX, a novel graphic. That is a piece of music from an album by Celestial Mechanic, who have two albums on Bandcamp called Citizen Void and The Signal Retransmission. What does that have to do with the book? Well, the music was created as a response to the fictional album in XX, which contains a review of this fictional album. But now the album actually exists, so this might be the first time in history where a review precedes the music. This to me sums up beautifully the ambition that goes into Ryan Hughes' first novel. I originally knew his work as a comics artist in 2000 AD and Dan Dare before I truly understood the breadth of his talent as a British graphic designer. You might not know his name, but you would definitely recognise his work on things like The Invisibles and Flex Mentallo. His new novel takes all of his talent and rolls it into this incredible piece of fiction that bleeds in and out of the real world. In XX, a mysterious signal of extraterrestrial origin has been detected. Jack Fenwick, an artificial intelligence expert, believes he can decode it. Jack and his associates create a way that allows them to step into the alien realm that the signal encodes, but when they enter this place, they discover that it is already occupied by strange entities that possibly come from Earth's past. Have these entities been created for such an eventuality, or are they the first line of defense against an alien intelligence that wants to declare war not for our planet, but for our minds? That is essentially the novel, but it is also so much more than that. I bought this novel on a whim after reading Grant Morrison speak about it, but when it arrived, I looked at the 980 pages in front of me and figured, this isn't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Who am I kidding? I'm really busy. I don't have the brain space to take this on. I don't have the arm strength to hold this up. Yet every time I walked past the bookshelf and looked at the cover, it kept calling out to me to give it a try. And I did. Yes, I did judge Ryan's book by the cover. But since he's a graphic designer, I feel like that's what I was meant to do. I flicked through the first few pages, and 3 weeks later, I finished the last page. That was while producing 6 podcasts, 7 live shows, a couple of guest projects, a trip to Adelaide and back. Like, it's been a full-on few weeks, and I still managed to rip through this tome. It was so compelling. I couldn't put it down. One of the great attributes about the story is that while it is full of big ideas, it is really easy reading. It clips along at such a brisk pace, and I found myself oscillating between moments of existential horror on one page to laughing out loud the next. Hughes' novel incorporates magazine and newspaper articles, fictitious Wikipedia pages, NASA transcripts, interview transcripts, emails, patterns and real-world signs, data visualizations, maps, alien alphabets, and an 8-part novella by a 1960s counterculture guru called Herschel Teague that sits adjacent but also informs the rest of the book. In fact, while I was reading the novella, I honestly couldn't work out where reality and fiction met. You can spend ages just looking at the covers for the novella that Ryan Hughes created, that is literally the front end papers. Like, I spent ages just looking at them and letting my imagination run wild. This is the type of ambitious and beautifully bonkers type of storytelling I love. There's so much for me to go back over now that I've finished the novel, and I can't wait to continue finding more and more as I casually flick through the pages. Like, as an example, I only found the album because there was a QR on one page, and at first I was like, oh, that's a nice flourish. But then I thought, maybe it works. Took out my phone and ta-da, there was a whole album. Like, that's the kind of thing that you're dealing with. It has a beautiful English sense of humour to it, and one of the main characters I pictured perfectly as actor Harry Lloyd. I won't say which one because I don't want to influence you in any way in case you check it out. But I could just visualise so much of everything that was happening in this book. I don't want to say too much about the story because it is more fun to have it reveal itself, but there was a moment where my head was so full of ideas that were absolutely beyond my emotional capabilities that I had to put the book down and do a little walk around my apartment to keep myself from sliding into some weird-ass agoraphobic meltdown. But straight after that, there was a part of the story that made me laugh so hard, all I could think was, Ryan, get the fuck out of my head. It was such a roller coaster in such a great way as well. This is a visualizing, stimulating treat with type and layout being important to the narrative. It is incredibly thought-provoking and will infect your mind with ideas and theories that will engage all of your senses. If you love sci-fi, the works of Stanley Kubrick, punk, the TV show Spaced, Arthur C. Clarke, Dada, Grant Morrison and the modernist movements of the 20th century, then this is the book for you. The Daily Mail described it as the Moby Dick of science fiction. The Financial Times said, XX keeps you turning the pages, engages with big ideas, and delivers an authentic jolt of awe as it takes its galaxy-spanning conceit to the limit. It also has my favourite quote of the year, and I know we're only into March, but I reckon I'll be hard-pressed to find a quote that surpasses this. But the quote is, how do you kill a bad idea? You have a better one. I loved Ryan Hughes' first novel, and I recommend XX, a novel graphic, to anyone who wants to lose themselves in a thrilling and mind-expanding story that brings intimacy to the universe we live in. Okay, let's talk about the penultimate episode of WandaVision, which allows us to see and experience all the events that led to the moment Westview became Wanda's sitcom playground. We now know that Agatha is indeed more than we suspected, and we see her origin story in Salem as her fellow coven of witches, including her mother, by the way, turn on her for dabbling in powers that are forbidden. But the thing is, Agatha is more powerful than all of her fellow witches, and she drains their powers, which also remind us, yeah, Agatha was the shark in the advert. You know, feeding on the yoga magic. Maybe all of these adverts have been Wanda's subconscious attempting to warn her about what was really happening in the real world. Agatha travels through Wanda's memories, and we see the family life that Wanda and Pietro originally were a part of. We also see that Wanda's powers are innate, rather than just a product of the Mind Stone. If anything, the Mind Stone's just supersized those powers. Later in her life, when Hydra experiment on Wanda, we see the Mind Stone change colour, and a woman, who looks like she's dressed in the classic costume, come floating towards her. Agatha refers to her as the Scarlet Witch, and now we have a feeling that this is a mythological figure. Or is this an older Wanda returning through her incredible power to warn the younger Wanda about what lays ahead? We don't know at this point. But it's all exciting. Also, her kind of mask thing looks still a bit horny. And I don't mean that in a sexy way, like in a little bit devilish. Maybe that is horny for you. Why are you bringing that up? That's a little bit weird. But anyway, maybe Mephisto still is on the outskirts of this story. Who knows? It's so much fun to theorize. We have no idea what lays ahead. Later we see Wanda grieving her lost brother and the empathy that Vision exhibits towards her. In the best scene of the series, Vision sits with Wanda and brings a level of poetry to her life that has been absent for many years. But what is grief if not love persevering, says Vision. and we are finally given a reason for Vision and Wanda to come together, and that is their mutual loneliness. This series does what the movies didn't have time for, how two very different people can find love with each other. After the events of Avengers Endgame, Wanda discovers Vision's disassembled body and places her hand on his head. Wanda whispers, "I can't feel you." And this reflects the moment in Avengers Infinity War when Wanda touched Vision's head and said, "I just feel you." When she's told she isn't allowed to give him a proper burial, she drives to the town of Westview, New Jersey. Why does she go there? Because Vision had bought a house for the two of them. And this is where the series begins. Agatha is obsessed with the level of Wanda's power. How did she get to this incredible level? We have one more episode to find out. But do not underestimate a woman's love. Let's bring in Rove. One of the criticisms leveled at Marvel movies is that they often tell you to care about characters without really showing you why. And did you initially feel this with Wanda and Vision, or had you read enough of their character arcs in the comics that you just filled in the gaps when you saw the movies?
Oh, I would say for the movies, yeah, I did see them as, well, probably more Wanda. I think Vision didn't feel like such a peripheral character. He had enough of a backstory with Jarvis via Ultron and out the other side. So that was, you felt like you connected with him a bit more, maybe just because I knew Paul Bettany, the actor. Maybe that kind of, you just, you know, like you don't feel you need to know as much about Tony Stark when you got to Robert Downey Jr. He's got so much charisma, it's being handed out to third world countries. And he does a lot of stuff wrong. And yeah, let's not forget he's an international arms dealer, ladies and gentlemen, but he's such a wise cracker, we don't care. So I think poor Wanda was just left in this world of, I don't quite know who she is. She obviously stepped up by the time we get to Endgame. She's very much one of those characters you enjoy seeing. But I think you're right. It's probably because I have decided I like her. She comes across as very cool on screen. I like the way she's portrayed. But if you asked me to tell you who she is in the MCU.
Yeah, her brother got killed.
Yeah, her brother got killed and she got sad and there were experiments and she's got powers. What are her powers? I don't know. How did she get them? You know, we're working on that.
And that's also what was great about that episode that we just watched is that's a tricky episode to pull off because you could end up just having a lot of information said to you. But what it ended up doing was it just went in between all the movies and filled in some gaps. So retrospectively, now we're really emotionally connected to each character.
And what? How is this for when you think you've seen every single origin story, the way that it can be done? This was such an amazing, this is what I love most about this episode, was you're getting the origin story to a character years after she's been first seen on screen and weeks after the show has, we're penultimate episode and we're getting the origin story in you know, the full episode dedicated to it. You wouldn't normally get that amount of time on screen to tell a character's origin. You know, I think one of the last Batman movies, they just squeezed it in the opening titles. So so I thought it was beautifully done. And as I was talking about last week, how this has elevated Wanda's character. Now I think we've officially got the Scarlet Witch mantle. I thought it was coming next week, but here we go. Isn't she now just suddenly one of those ones, if they said, oh, we've got a Scarlet Witch movie coming, you'd say, absolutely, bring it on.
Well, this is why these TV series are such a good idea. And I wonder if we will get more origins where we'll just, rather than have those origin movies, like Doctor Strange feels a little bit like magic Tony Stark in the way the beats are hit.
Well, a lot of that, even in this episode, we're getting a bit more information and backstory on Wanda's powers. None of these things are ever properly explained in any kind of comic book or universe, really. It's just too hard and too complicated. And because magic is usually the answer, But the fact that you've got the Agnes character saying, I need to know what your powers are, because what I'm seeing around me and how you've done it is beyond even my capabilities. And how beautifully done was her origin story in her own right, where the wonderful twist of, oh, no, you're not here as a witch during the Salem trials with a bunch of humans around you. It's your fellow coven are putting you on trial for casting spells above your station. And she's like, well, yeah, because I'm heaps good at it. Who wants to be turned into a prune? So when she's the one saying the one to Wanda, kid, where'd you get these powers from? Because I am impressed. That's when it fills in all those gaps of, okay, you know, the Mind Stone maybe gave something to her, plus the trauma and what that can bring out of someone. You hear stories of people who find super strength when their child is trapped under a vehicle or something, and they, you know, the human body can just do incredible things. So all of that really makes sense and is plausible. But for all to be given context through the character of Agnes and her perspective, and then her wanting to take Wanda on these flashbacks to go, show me when it happened and show me how it happened.
It also tells us that the shark really was her, like the shark was feeding in the advert, was feeding on the magic. And it also makes sense of her first line in the first episode where she turns up and says, sorry, I'm late. And that's probably because she's been looking over what's happening in Westview and thought, oh, I have to go and check this out. And then she's slipped into this world. I'm curious, do you want another big bad like a Thanos? Do you want something like Mephisto or Nightmare? Or would you prefer the Marvel Universe to break down into different skirmishes so we've got all these different sort of things happening?
I feel it needs one, a big bad, only because that's what they've set up. And I can't speak for everybody how many people are necessarily watching WandaVision. And how many people will or won't allow it into their headcanon of it being part of the cinematic universe. It feels that the movies need something like that only because it's been set up that way. I am quite happy with a character like Agnes, who isn't necessarily one of your major ones. And she's a bit of an off, on again, off again nemesis for Wanda anyway in the comic books. She's sometimes an enemy, sometimes a mentor. And you can kind of see that happening a little bit in WandaVision, where she's almost like, I'm antagonizing you to show you what your powers are capable of. So I think there will be a something at the end of this. You know, one of Agnes's first lines, I think it's episode two, when one of the other characters says, oh, the devil's in the detail, and she, aside to Wanda, says that's not the only place he is. Wanda's got this map that's brought her to Westview in the first place. We don't necessarily assume that that was sent from Vision. You know, it says V, but I don't know. I haven't really thought about what the V could be, somebody else, but certainly someone having brought, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, the idea that there's so many layers. So the idea that someone's brought Wanda there, and that's brought these powers out of her through her grief, which has attracted Agnes's attention to go, I want to come and see how you made this happen. Suggests there is still, we've still got a somewhere else to go. And with one episode left,
I'm excited for Anti-Vision, because it feels like if Vision in the Hex is emotional Vision, because that's what Wanda's conjured up, then we have Cold Mechanical Vision, which kind of calls back to a John Byrne storyline with West Coast Avengers. Maybe he'll become whole by merging both of those. But also, Paul Bettany keeps going on about how there's an actor he's always wanted to work with. Is it going to turn out to be Paul Bettany?
I mean, how funny would that be if all along his... For as much as your deep dive last week had me thinking, oh, my God, you've absolutely nailed it. Maybe it is just, yeah, I get to work alongside myself, which is brilliant. So, yeah, White Vision, as I know very little about, except that as far as I recall in the comic books, he's the Vision that was created to, I guess, like we've seen in the show, we want our own vision. We don't know how we're going to try to do what we can and get the technology to do it. But this one doesn't have the memories and emotion of the original.
He's essentially an emotionless weapon, which is kind of what it feels like S.W.O.R.D. wanted him to be. I was just doing a quick look at Marvel characters that begin with V. All I could think of was Vishanti, who isn't that one of Doctor Strange's spells that he makes? And then it wouldn't be Von Strucker, would it?
Or Von Doom? No, probably not. That's where you go. I think, look, the idea that it's probably just easier to not have to write the full name Vision. I think it's done the job that it was intended to do. Because if you're trying to be a bit sly about it, you wouldn't be trying to do it in a love heart. You would just lie and say, oh, yeah, it's me, Vision. Here's a map of where you need to be. Love and kisses, see you soon. And then go, surprise, it wasn't really. But we've got the idea of who's the bigger big bad. We've got, I think we'll see, you know, full force Wanda here. We've still got Monica, you know, who knows where she's ended up. And, yeah, and emotionless white Vision on the way. So it's going to be a lot in a half hour. Let's not forget, these are short episodes.
Are there any, because of what we've seen happen with the way they've worked these characters, are there any other Marvel characters from the movies that you would like to see get the WandaVision treatment?
Oh, that's a great question.
I feel like we're going to get it with Hawkeye.
I was thinking that he would be the one.
He always gets such short shrift as a character because in the comics, he's a hothead. Like, he's the one who's always calling Cap old man, and, you know, he's funny. He's a little bit more Han Solo. But in the movies, they've made Tony Stark a little bit more that. And in the knockdown effect, that's reduced Hawkeye to, he's got a family. He's grieving. He's not grieving.
He's got a family. He doesn't have any powers, but a seemingly never-ending supply of arrows in his quiver, so that's important. I think he'd be the one. It's safe to say he's that one that you look at going, oh, well, that gives me hope. I could be an Avenger if I just practice my archery skills, right? Yeah, if he can do it. So, yeah, I think that would be a good one.
I think maybe Hawkeye feels like the number one character for me. Like, I'd be quite happy to see if they're not going to cover it. I don't know if they're going to cover it in the Black Widow movie, but if you saw some of their adventures, like if you got an 8-part series of things they were getting up to and it's a little bit more spy-driven and action-driven, I'd be into that. And then I guess on a cosmic level, it'd be kind of fun to get a story with the Collector. Like, imagine a crazy ass story with the Collector trying to pick things up all over the universe and how that goes right or wrong. And because it's Benicio del Toro and it was such a weird type of performance, you could bring the Grandmaster in. It could be this weird sibling thing.
Yeah. There's the wonderful thing with this series is just how much breath they gave it. I mean, this is normally something, you know, when you and Ben are talking about a film and saying, oh, do you reckon this could be a series? The idea that could this series have been a film, and you think, no, I don't know that it could. It's, you know, the fact that it is episodic works into the narrative of how the show is structured. How you would get to the end of a WandaVision episode being, hey, this one's set in the 1950s, and then next week you come back and it's a brand new set and it's a decade later, seemingly. I don't know how you would be able to portray that on screen without everyone getting an end credit sequence and a week off, and then we come back and we watch it again. So this idea now that they've been able to find this way to tap into telling stories this way is, I honestly just think it's game changing, especially for, I mean, they've been doing it with Star Wars, so it makes sense to be doing it with Marvel. But man, just the way they're tapping into
it really leaves you kind of hungry for each episode, and it's also got me really looking forward to not only the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, but we've also got Loki coming up after that. It's like, okay, well, keep feeding me. I'm up for this. Grief is an experience that is a fascinating one in movies and TV and all sorts of entertainment, because it's often used as a way, and probably in the real world as well, as an opportunity to kind of treat other people poorly. Like, oh, you got to understand they're grieving. But that doesn't sometimes take away from the fact that they're being a bit off themselves. Do you think there should be any fallout from Wanda's behavior?
No, I don't think so. Because, again, I think her grief has been manipulated as it has gone along, and it seems she's been holding so much of it in, and then finally, you know, it all just comes almost literally exploding out of her. That final straw of she thinks she's going to find Vision somehow, he's found a way back, but it turns out to not be the case. And whether it's because the note was written before his death, or again, it's a trap laid by somebody else for everything that's happened since, I think it's fair to say that's not her fault. And what a wonderful thing to sort of think that's the catalyst for everything that's happened. And then there was that wonderful quote from Vision about how grief is love finding its way back through, or love persevering, I think was his way of phrasing it, which I think is exactly it. You know, why would Wanda be feeling this way if not for the fact that she's, you know, lost her parents, she's lost her brother, she's lost her love. And then it finally just all came out of her. So I think the repercussions of that are not her fault at all. I mean, geez, wouldn't we all like to somehow have the ability to trap ourselves in a fictitious world based on your favorite TV shows from when you were a kid? Man, I'd be running around with the members of G-Force and jumping in Doctor Who's time machine and battling Astro Boy and getting on the three-wheeled goodies bike.
I feel like you just ticked all of my boxes as well. I'd definitely be up for G-Force. I'd be totally up for that. That's such a funny thing to think about. I'd be in the swamp in MASH as a doctor for some reason, but I'd be on the Hawkeye side making fun of Major Burns or Winchester.
I think too, because it's really that the hex is one, and its version of Westview is just Wanda's way of coping with the grief. She's just kind of shut herself in. So also anything that's happened within there, people infiltrating that to get what they need to extrapolate out of her, whether it's from Agnes, whether it's from, let's not forget, sort of outside trying to bash their way in too. And so anything that's been happening inside is her just saying, everyone just fuck off and leave me alone. So yeah, that's absolutely fine. If someone's in that sort of emotional turmoil and you bother them and they lash out, I don't think it's their fault at all.
It's interesting to see as well that when we see the place before she takes over, like the woman from the first episode is sitting by herself, but when we see her in the first episode, she's married. And then we see the guy putting up piano lessons that nobody's taking, and then he was in the talent quest.
He was playing the piano. So, you know, let's remember that next time Vision snaps someone out of their Westview haze and they're like, oh, dear God, help me, dear, help me. You know, this place was a dump before Wanda got here. You were all miserable. And now you're living the life of every day's a sitcom, and you could be Bryan Cranston. Look, it makes you do realize of all the Bryan Cranston shows that Wanda could have grown up watching, thank goodness it wasn't Breaking Bad. That would have been, who knows what this hex would have turned out like. That would have been.
That's a very different conversation. Is it funny because he got hurt grievously? No, it's not that kind of show. Is this funny because it's super dark? Yes, yes, it is. That is that show. That body that they've dissolved in the bathtub falling through, it's funny because it's awful. You're right, Vision. Why are we watching this?
It doesn't need a laughter track. It doesn't help.
I'll let you get out on this. We all know that this leads into the next Doctor Strange movie. So what do you think is going to happen in the last episode?
I do think there's still a reveal to come. I think we still have a big bad to come. And I realize that's a big ask. It might be done in the mid-credits sequence where we find out there's something else, like maybe Agnes is thwarted and there's a last-minute shout-out from her that summons something. I still think the twins are going. I don't hold out hope for the boys. I know it's not quite that type of show, but I don't know if you want one last thing to push Wanda across the line. And there is something too, like I feel like could there be something in a Doctor Strange movie where the vision, no pun intended, we see of what looks like a modern take on the traditional Scarlet Witch costume when she was back in the lab and the Mind Stones come out and she just sees that silhouette of what looks like her outfit, but not like we saw her in the Halloween episode. So is there a something where, you know, we get to that point where she is the Scarlet Witch in her full glory, and it's her that comes back, thanks to Doctor Strange, into her own timeline to use the Mind Stone to give herself her own power?
This is exactly how I want my storytelling to unfold. All over the place, but if you're patient, it all comes together.
Absolutely. But also, again, I'm perfectly fine if all we do is wrap up what we've got with WandaVision and Westview, you know? Monica, there's Captain Marvel 2 is on its way soon enough. So, you know, if we pick that up there, that's fine. I tell you what, if you want to mention another, if you want to ask about another series that I would watch, The Adventures of Jimmy and Darcy on the Road Solving Mysteries Together.
Yeah, and because rather than having the believer and the non-believer, you would have the super serious and the quippy and the super serious trying to be funny and learning magic tricks and the quippy. That would be a fun dynamic.
And just like, even if it's like they're just going off and just doing tiny little offshoot stories, or they're sort of the cleanup crew after the major stars that were in the movie have disappeared. They're kind of coming in and filing out the report, doing the paperwork afterwards. Like, that would be fun.
When all the heroes have moved on.
Yes.
I'd watch that.
Yeah, and the original townsfolk who were, you know, sad, lonely people at tables and putting piano lesson signs on the shop window are sitting there talking to them, just trying to find out what happened.
Remember the TV series In Treatment? And it was like four episodes a week and you'd have yeah, I would do it like that. I'd have heaps of them. Like, give me 30 episodes of that each season and I would be totally into it. That was great. Thank you for that. And I'm looking forward to see if we're right, if we're wrong, if it's Ralph Fiennes or it's just Paul Bettany wrapped to be able to work with himself.
Either way, everyone wins.
I'm pleased to present this interview with young comedian Oliver Twist. I've had the pleasure of performing with Oliver around Sydney, and we recently appeared on a big lineup show where he showed us how he continues to shine. He has a one-man play called Jarlie at the Griffin Theatre from the 16th to the 27th of March. I'll post a link for it at the Big Squid Facebook page for you. This is a fun and fascinating chat, so let's get straight to it and welcome Oliver to Big Squid. Before we started recording, you said the sentence that I love to hear from young people, or from anyone, to be honest,
right?
Which is, I've just started getting into David Bowie, and I was like, "Well, welcome to the podcast." what did you know about Bowie beforehand, and what got you interested in him?
I didn't know a whole lot about Bowie. What got me interested into Bowie? What was I watching? I was watching a comedy special on Netflix by what's that New York comedian? Colin?
Conan?
Not Conan.
Oh, sorry.
Conan is also from New York. Yeah. No, Colin. Colin.
I can't think off the top of my head.
What is his last name? It's called Blue State, Red State.
Oh, I can't think of his last name. Hang on, just keep talking and I reckon, or look it up.
Yeah, Blue State, Red State. At the end of that special, he ends with Love Is Lost from the next day.
Yep.
The 2013 Bowie album. And I was like, this song is freaking amazing.
Yeah.
And maybe this was like 2 years ago that I was watching this. And I was like, I've never really, like, I knew of Bowie, but I've never really gotten into him up until that moment where I was like, oh, let me dive deep into, like, actually listening to his music. So I started with that album the next day and kind of like made my way backwards and forth.
So you started with his second to last album.
I know.
Which is great.
It's great. It's a great album.
But I also, I think getting into any artist, especially, by the way, it's Colin Quinn. That's who you're thinking of, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
So part of what's really fun about getting into any artist at any point is just coming at it from different angles. Like, so for me, I got into Bowie in 1983 when he was hitting it big with Let's Dance. But that meant I could go back and I had all these years of albums.
There was Bowie before 1983?
Yeah, look, I'm telling you, this is going to blow your mind. There's heaps. It goes all the way back to 65, if you
That's
really want to do
insane.
The deep dive.
What is that time?
I know. I also, before I started recording, you asked me when I started doing comedy, and I told you, and you were like, far out, that's a long time ago. No, this grey isn't just for show.
It's very interesting time at the moment. Like, I have three younger sisters, and they all spend time on TikTok, like a whole lot. And their concept of comedy is all these young people performing on TikTok.
Yep.
And they were born, like, after the 90s, which to me, like, it just baffles my mind. So anything before or after my time is like, wow.
Well, hang on, what year were you born?
96. So I was born in 96, and there's like all these like TikTok comedians, whatever, that were born in like 2005.
Oh yeah, it's insane, isn't it? And wait till you're doing stand-up and one day you're performing with someone and you realize you've been performing longer than, which is what is happening to me right now.
All right. Longer than they've been alive?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, getting back to the artist thing, getting into an artist at any point, I always, you know, there can be, especially in fandom, there can be a toxicity to it where people can kind of get on their high horse. Oh, yeah, you got into it through that way.
Right.
My take is, if you discover something or someone and you get in wherever you get in, whatever, like, that's great. That means you've got this whole world to explore. And I'm quite envious of the position that you're in.
Yeah.
Because you have a whole lot of stuff to discover. And like during the lockdown, people who listen to this podcast would know that I went back and listened to a 70s band called Roxy Music, led by Brian Ferry.
Uh-huh.
And I read an article where it was talking about the punk movement in the UK, and the only two music artists that the punk movement didn't turn on were David Bowie and Roxy Music. And I was like, Roxy Music? I know a few of their songs. And so that sparked my curiosity, and then I went back to their first album. And then I listened to everything in sequential order, and it's like, you know what that was? That was a really good couple of months.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
Yeah, just diving into it. For me, it's always been like discovering an artist at a moment in time. I don't like going with the mold. Like, I'm not about to like, oh, this is what we're listening to, so let's listen to this. I like the artist to invoke me with their piece of work, album, whatever, at a moment in time. So when I started listening to Kendrick Lamar on his third album, To Pimp a Butterfly.
Right.
And a lot of people go, oh, you weren't here for the first two. And it's like, that to me is the album that spoke to me the most. And I just stumbled upon it. And then I went back to listen to the other two, obviously. And then everything afterwards, after that. But it's kind of like whatever speaks to you. And it's a very specific moment in Kendrick Lamar's career at that point when he released To Pimp a Butterfly. The other two are different. So it's like, yeah, I can see how the circles that I was in at that time, this is the album that found me. Or at the very least, this is the kind of music I gravitated towards too.
Yeah.
And in that way, that's more commendable for me. I appreciate that, to just go, oh, this is where I found myself in that space.
And what was it about that album that spoke to you at that point?
That album spoke to me specifically because it's It's a very deeply political album. It's when Obama was in office, and the cover of the whole album is him and his homies from Campton at the very front of the White House.
Yeah.
Just like shirtless, like drinking, just like middle finger to the camera. Just one of those. And I was like, oh, this is just like a very fuck you moment in a way. And it's like deeply aggressive, unapologetic, just telling you like where he comes from and how he's ended up to that point. And there's a lot of themes of like what it means to be black in America.
Yeah.
And that was 2015, and I just got in Australia 2014, which to me was interesting because I never, when I was in Malawi before I came to Australia, I've never thought of myself as black. Everyone else around me was black.
Right.
The concept of being black is within the white gaze. So I get to Australia, surrounded by white people, and they're like, you're black. I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that the last 18 years. So it was like a really good album to listen to in terms of like what it means to kind of like live in a white society.
Yeah, that's it's a pretty amazing album, and the time that it came out was a little bit ahead of the curve of where the discourse was, in the political language. And just one byline, have you listened to, there's something specific I want to get back to, but have you listened to Bowie's last album, Black Star?
I have.
Yeah, so he and his producer were big fans of Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, yeah?
So, you know, they were always listening to his producer that he worked on and off with for decades. They were always across different types of music and were big fans. They never stopped being fans of stuff. I think that's a really important aspect as an artist, is to always be still having the joy of watching another artist work and learning from them. And over the years, you can hear where, you know, like in the 70s, you can hear when Bowie's doing his soul music, and then you can hear when he's fusing African-American music with the austere kind of industrial sounds of krautrock, you know. And so you can hear a little bit of the joy they were getting out of Lamar in Black Star, which is always commendable, I think.
It's always very, very good to see sparks of inspiration in other artists from like other genres. And like that album is deeply infused with jazz and funk, which is, you know, as time is concerned, it's like before my time of like actually listening to music and enjoying it. And I would still be able to like connect with it. And that's the beauty of like a great artist at a moment in time. They're able to take a certain period of time, make it feel modern and then palatable to like the kind of audience that are there in that moment.
Yeah, and not being afraid to, I think there was like a snobbery to look down and say that you were a fan of other things as well, and just being blatant and saying, I really like this and this is what I learned from it. Because then what that does is I discovered lots of artists through Bowie being a fan.
Right.
So to be honest, I discovered that Kendrick Lamar album, which I'd heard about and I knew I'd read about. But when I heard about the influence on Black Star, then I went backwards and then listened to that and went, oh, yeah, right.
Interesting.
And so I have that on vinyl and have like listened to it quite, the vinyl experience.
Yeah, the vinyl experience. It's the real experience. it's good.
It's fun. But so you were talking about coming to Australia and suddenly realizing, oh, hang on a sec, I'm considered this, which I've never been considered before in being black. And I've only ever really experienced that a few times in my life. Once when I was in New York and I went and saw a Thurston Moore concert and realized
in blackface
and
then they were like, oh,
and they were like, this guy seems pretty cool, why don't we hang out with him forever, is exactly how it went down.
You're New York.
I think my mate and I, we were the only two white people in the room, and it was not a big deal. Like it wasn't anything other than realizing, oh, I don't think I've ever been the minority before. And the only other two times was once in a bar in Karratha, and we realized everyone was Aboriginal.
Yeah. And the comedian I was with and myself, we were the only white people. And then, funnily enough, Tom Gleason and I went and saw Fear of a Brown Planet with Nazim and Amir.
All right.
And they were doing a lot of stuff. And it was really, we were finding it really exhilarating to be sitting there and once again be the minority and feel everything that's going on and hearing these thoughts that were, you know, different to everything else we'd been experiencing. And it's fascinating, especially like the life of privilege I've led to not be in that situation too often, and but when I have, to find it exhilarating. And I'm sure that it was a different experience at times when you first came here.
A different experience of...
of, you know, like sometimes it would have been exhilarating, like I'm sure in some comedy rooms,
right,
the ability to be different
is
exhilarating, but there would have been times when it is...
For the
scary.
Longest time, I was like the only, you know, black comedian in Brisbane doing shows. It's like, and then maybe I took that for granted, but it's also like that was never kind of my focus.
No,
it's also like, you know, I get into this with a lot of people because you want to share an experience at the very least, and experiences can be universal regardless of color. Just because someone tells me they're white, it doesn't mean I have to believe it, you know.
Right.
It's the same way that if I jump on stage and I tell you I'm black, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to believe it. Like, what's inherently underneath that experience? So I was definitely like something that people had never seen before in Brisbane. And as good as that is for like getting more gigs and more work, I didn't want to be like something. I didn't want to be an exotic story that people would listen to. I wanted to share something, something more tangible, you know, something of like an experience. It's like, oh, you could also kind of been in my position, or regardless of what position I was in, this is how it felt for me. So if you could also share that feeling, that's the goal. And then enjoy within those experiences, like the humor that came from it.
And I think it's really interesting what you say about it. It's a foot in the door when you start out.
Yeah.
But then the industry is quick to decide this is the box that you're going to fit into, and it can be difficult to take the opportunities and then push back against that.
Right.
And so, was there a point in the Brisbane, time that you were performing in the scene there regularly that you were sort of suddenly feeling a bit like, I don't really want to be pigeonholed? Or was it something that you didn't really notice until you moved to Sydney?
I've never felt it to the fullest of extent. I feel like it's more of a personal choice. There are people that really lean into that,
yeah,
and that's their business.
Oh yeah,
to each his own. But for the most part, it was like if you're good and you can be good on stage and be professional, that's about all we want from you. But the pressure was definitely very real to kind of be like, oh man, it would be so easy if I could do this type of jokes,
yeah,
and just literally get the paycheck and then go home, or just get that footstep and step further.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had to step back. There's moments I've had to step back and interrogate like what I want to say and my intention and how it's coming across. And I think if there's anything in terms of like, people I enjoy listening to, people I enjoy watching across platforms of like artistry, is like the intention and how it's coming across, and making sure that it is your intention. If it is your intention to lean into that, you know, that cultural background or like whatever you're using, then by all means.
Yeah.
But I never felt it in Brisbane. It's also in Brisbane, there's like, I mean, for the most part, it's doing rooms where it's just, you know, punters with, you know, just beers. They don't care. They're like, they do not.
Oh, yeah. I
went like, oh, give us your background. Like, give us where you come. It's like, for the most part, they're like, if you can make me laugh, that's about it.
Well, and that's like some of the better rooms. Like there are some rooms where it's like, mate, like the dogs are about to race, and can you just get on with it? Because I've got a lot riding on this.
Yeah.
What's that? That's the the unfortunately for me named Hamilton Hotel was one of those. I think I did that once. I was Hamilton Hotel. This will be funny.
My god!
And then I got up and I was like,
was bleak.
It is bleak.
Someone gave me $5 at that place. Because I did a joke about getting donations. I don't even remember the joke. I don't do it anymore. But this guy thought it was so good, and he just went on stage, didn't say a word, just put $5 right like beneath my feet when I was performing.
Right. He thought you're a busker.
He thought I was a busker, which is like, I mean... Jesus, I was like, I took the money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's like, that'd be insane.
It's like, it would be rude not to. But yeah, that place had very bleak moments.
It was like you had a physical Patreon and that guy wanted to, like, I'm not on the net, but how about I see you every month, I'll give you $5.
In the moment. Oh, man, that's true power, the power of comedy.
So did you move here with your family, or did you move here by yourself and your family still back home, or...?
That's a tricky question. I was like, where is home? I have not been. I was born in Rwanda, left when I was 4.
Right.
We flew to Malawi and lived there until I was 18. And then I came here with my immediate family. I have my aunt and my cousins still in Rwanda. They're pretty happy there now that things are calm.
Yeah.
Which is good. But yeah, there's been conversation like in the group chats of like maybe wanting for them to come over at some point, but they're pretty happy there, which is fine. And then obviously for us, we have not gone back because it takes a while to get a passport. I just got mine last year and then the pandemic came, so I couldn't travel anywhere really. But yeah, my immediate family are in Queensland.
Okay.
So yeah.
And that would be that'd be nice if they could come out here. But if things are calm, and that's their home, that's good. You know, how is it economically now? Because like I knew going back, it was precarious. And is it on the upswing at all, or is it just
the economy of Rwanda,
or has it flattened?
That's what most people like to tell me, that it's doing good.
Right,
it is doing good. It's just
or is good. Better, which is different to good, right?
Yeah, is good better. It's like most people I have a conversation with, and it comes up that I am from Rwanda. They tell me that it's economically doing better, as if economic progress is in itself inherently like a good thing.
Right?
It might not be. You know, the people might be dehumanized in a great economy, which happens in most countries in Africa. You know, you'd be doing economically good, but the human rights are like horrible. If people are happy, then I'm happy. As far as I know, it's a dictatorship. The president there has never lost an election since 1994, which is when the genocide happened, and he became president. And every kind of like democratic election that's happened, he's won it.
Yeah.
That's unprecedented in any kind of like, you know, democratic country. So as far as I'm concerned, the economy doing good has nothing, you know, it doesn't add anything to the happiness of the people in the country.
Right. I was kind of thinking just more in a direct line to your specific family, if they're feeling relatively positive compared to previously.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say most people. They're fine. They're fine. It could be better, but they're fine. Like, we're not scrambling around.
Yeah, for sure. And moving to another country is not a decision that you make. Yeah, you know what? Like, for lunch, I might have the gnocchi, and then Friday I might move to Brisbane. It's a big choice, right?
Gnocchi and Brisbane sounds good.
That sounds okay. But I also, you know, what you say about economic progress dehumanizing people, and I think you could say that is not just about Like, of course, it's concentrated and worse in places like Africa, but I think you also see it in America as well, and that's where you get those... It's the poor people who get disenfranchised and get treated as numbers that leads to all of these kind of issues. So, anyway, it's a roundabout way of saying I think you're completely right about progress not necessarily being progress.
Yeah, there's form of progress that are good... And those, as far as I'm concerned, involve the people.
Yeah.
You can't call an America a progressive country if they have, I don't know, a huge percentage of their people in prisons. Like, you can't call it a free country, the land of the free. You can't really say that when, you know, half the people, like, it's in terms of, like, how are you treating your people? If it's a government that should govern the people... more than like a perception of how you're looking into the world. So to me, that's important.
It's just really sad that, and it's, I don't want to sound naive with this. This is not even really necessarily a new thought, but it is just a pity that 95% of people in positions of power are there for positions of power.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the spin on, hey, I'm doing it for you. And it's like, are you? Are you really?
Yeah.
You know, all the, you know, you're seeing it across the board with things like Brexit and, you know, suddenly all of that's really starting to kick in and you're starting to get the stories out of the UK now where people said, oh, I voted for Brexit. I thought this was going to be a good idea. And now this business I had has lost all its work because it's been sold to that MP's buddy's business, you know, and it's hard to maintain a level of positivity and a desire to continue to work towards making change and making things better. But I also think that is the responsibility of the individual who wants to be a part of society is to, like, I don't think it's a good idea to push it all out of your head and not connect with the world.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But, you know. I try to do that, and that's also why I don't watch the news that much. Try to keep a level of sanity.
Oh, yeah. I stopped watching the news a long time ago. Like, a long time ago. There's a philosopher out of Europe called Alain de Botton. Are you familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah, he has that book, News. Is it News? Yeah, I think it's titled News. I remember reading that, and like, oh, he's probably, you know... He's got a few things that I agree with him, a few things that I disagree with him. But for the most part, like, I think the point he's trying to make is that it's not a very groundbreaking idea. It's like, if it bleeds, it bleeds. Like, that's how the news operate these days, I think. So I think you'd be, you know, an idiot to just, like, be like, oh, I'm just watching this and then I'm being informed. I think a more thorough work, deep dive into what the issues are, which at the very least we all understand.
Right.
And so you can feel it. You know it's happening. You don't need to have that, like, confirmation thing again and again and again and again. It just becomes repetitive.
It's interesting, though, so I'm quite surprised, like, here in Australia, and we are recording this in roughly the middle of Feb, and you talk to people... who, say as an example, I've got lots of friends in Adelaide who can't understand why I'm not doing the Adelaide Fringe.
Oh, yes.
And I was trying to say to them, you know, well, I don't want to put up thousands and thousands of dollars behind months and months of work to go home and do a show that could potentially be shut down an hour before I walk on stage. And it's just not the upside of this all working is not worth all of the potential stuff that could go wrong. And so I'm not going to do it. And not everyone, that's unfair. A few people have just been a bit like, yeah, but we've got this under control. And it's like, just look overseas and see how one thing goes wrong.
Right.
And we're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's going to happen, but... just be aware.
And just be aware.
And those people have been like, oh, yeah, geez, I looked at the UK and thought, far out. It's like, yeah, that's been happening, like, constantly.
Right.
So trying to get that balance is...
Yeah.
So you have to put the news out. But also,
you want to put your finger like it's the same way like great artists do it. Is like they kind of like study other great artists like almost obsessively. They're like, what are they up to on this very second?
Yeah,
are they about to do something I'm about to do?
Yeah,
in the same way that is what should befall a good citizen.
Yeah,
it's like, hey, what is the other person doing? Am I doing something to better their day or better this shared space that we're having?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that extends to the little suburb you live. That extends to further and further to the nation that you live. And that extends further and further to neighboring countries and all that. And within that, I think if you're constantly aware, without having someone to tell you what is going on, you can be at the center of it all without being overwhelmed by it all. Like, pick a day where that is your main focus out of the week. That's one day out of 7 days. And then you can do whatever you want for the rest of the 6 days.
That sounds great. I'm totally into this idea. I wish more people would do it.
Oh, it's like no one would do it.
Some people do it.
Some people do it.
Some people do it. It feels, I've noticed in... So I listen, I'm a big NBA basketball fan, and I've been listening to a lot of NBA podcasts while the season is on. And I've noticed, sometimes I notice these things happen at grassroots level, and it gives me a little bit of positivity about where the world might be going. And I've talked about this with a few people. But I'll repeat it because I'm hoping that it is a sign of good things to come, which is, you know, the basketballer Kyrie Irving?
Yes.
So you know how he just disappeared from the Nets for a few weeks?
Yeah.
And he's got this massive contract. And 6 months ago, everyone would have been just ragging on him.
What
is this guy doing? This is his job.
Right.
But every conversation I've heard has been prefaced with, well, we don't know what's going on in his personal life,
right?
So I'm just going to comment on the basketball.
Yes.
And it's like, great. Like, yes, that's exactly how it should always have been. But that to me is, if it's in at the grassroots level in the sporting world,
yes,
hopefully that's where the way we talk and the way we communicate is going in the macro level of the world.
Do you think that's afforded more to artists and entertainers more than people with essential jobs?
Yeah, look,
like what might be considered like an essential part of work?
Well, what I hope is that it is not just in that world, and it's like a synecdoche of the greater good. So what I hope from that is maybe an essential worker is getting that recommendation or that understanding, you know.
Right.
So I'm hoping that that's filtering through society in general.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Because those people need it much more than, you know, other people. But even then, I don't even like judging what other people are going through. But, you know, just because a job doesn't get you endorsements and a sneaker deal doesn't mean that you can't take some time off and be
right.
And not taken for granted.
Yeah. What's interesting about that, the like following that thread, is that like sport and like essential work is kind of like a kind of work you need to be pure while you're doing it. You know what I mean? Like, it's the purest form of work in terms of like, you're not intoxicated. With the exception of that Smith dude that was smoking weed and going on the basketball court playing all the time.
J.R.
Smith. It's so funny. But like, at the very least, it's a kind of work where you're like, oh, yeah. Or if something happens, something must have gone horribly wrong.
Right.
But then you come into like artist, right? Where, you know, substances and all that, that's kind of like being used sometimes to like mask or even further the artistry.
Yeah.
And it's like people are less forgiving. I remember like Amy Winehouse, like,
right.
And people were like, oh, why is she showing up to shows drunk? And then it's like, well, if someone else showed up, well, drunk to work,
yeah,
you would be like, oh shit, there's some
greater issue here.
Yeah.
We need to take them aside. Whereas, well, I wonder if that's because there is also, for poor Amy, she had lots of enablers around her maybe and had she was in a position of power. And when you're in a position of power, like if I'm Hammo who works at the store and I'm turning up drunk, someone's probably going to take me aside.
Somebody's like, hey.
But if I'm Hammo and I'm the manager and everyone's probably talking behind my back but still doing what I say, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think we've seen that, you know, we're recording this a couple of days after Eddie Maguire having to stand down from the Collingwood Football Club. And, you know, we're seeing lots of people in positions of power who have outstayed their welcome. And, you know, what's fascinating about it is who the things that they stand down over are so obvious and should have been dealt with immediately when they went down. But it's because they live in this world where they're protected and surrounded by yes people.
Yeah.
That even when a criticism comes in, the defences flank them and protect them. And even when finally they have to give up and say, oh, well, I have to step down, even then they still don't quite comprehend how they're not the victim.
Yeah.
And it's...
it's wild.
It's wild, right.
It's wild when they're like, huh, I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, it's like, no, it's really obvious. Like, go back and look at everything really closely and take your ego out of it. I think it's important to be able to look at when you've made mistakes.
But it's also very terrifying to see how many people are not, like, away. Like, me, I get that. I think about that all the time, the element of... self-delusion within society and purely like artistry, which is like it's a long game.
Yeah.
And then you don't want to be like 5-10 years in and you're like, I was so self-deluded that I didn't know that maybe this is not for me. It's very like I like the, you know, like the tenacity to go, oh yeah, I can pursue this, but I'm also very objective and clear-headed and be like, is this for me? Can I contribute something within something that I'm getting involved with? And that's kind of important.
Did you feel that when you first, like, how old were you when you first started doing stand-up?
I was 19.
19.
Yeah.
And when did you have that thought? Did you have that at 19 or did you...
I had that at 19, 20. I knew... I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew I wanted to contribute something and kind of go live within it something that was not there before. Because, like, what do I look like coming, trying to do what everyone has done it before? Just to push the conversation further.
Yeah.
To push the conversation further and the platform, which is great, which I love.
Yeah.
And that to me was something worthwhile.
You know, when you moved over, I want to get back to that. When you moved over with your family, whose inspiration was it? Was it your mum or your dad, or was it a joint thing? Or was it you sort of suggesting, hey, let's go over there? How did the idea come to move to Brisbane?
There was no idea or inspiration. This was a work of God.
Oh, really?
As the people say. No. Yeah. It was a purely coincidence. So we were living in Malawi in refugee camp, Zaleka, after mum and dad fled the genocide in 1994. So we get there, and one of the things... is you have two options. You can either go back if the country is safe, which it was not, or you can go to a third country, as they call it, because the country you've arrived in from fleeing is the second country. So you have literally one country you can go to. If you do leave Malawi, for instance, like my family, if we left to go, say, I don't know, South Africa or anywhere else, that would have been our third country and wouldn't be allowed to live anywhere else until... we became a citizen of that, which is what happened when we came to Australia. This was our third country, and we couldn't leave. It wasn't our choice. It was UNHCR's choice. So UN, under UNHCR, which is the refugee agency, they get to decide where your family goes. You know, it wasn't like spin the wheel of...
right.
And then like, oh, pick Australia, which, I mean, super lucky that we came to Australia.
Right.
Very happy here. The economy is stable enough, people welcoming enough to kind of like find your footing and your place within it. And mom and my sisters are very happy. which is good. So yeah, it wasn't much of our choice. It took it took a long time to get here, because you get there and then you have to apply for resettlement, which on average takes 25 years.
Yeah,
for like a, which is a, it's a long time.
That's a long time.
That's someone's career right there.
Right.
It's like, and then like, imagine if that's how long it took you to start a career. It's like this backwards thing,
yeah,
which is also very dehumanizing to a moment and think, oh, how further someone is already ahead of the game before you start.
Yeah.
It's
not just someone's career, that's someone's life.
That's someone's life.
Yeah.
Entire life. So like, It took me what, 19 years to kind of like discover like art, like good art, and to start getting involved with it. So I had a lot of like learning to do in terms of like, oh man, I don't know this person, I don't know this person, I don't know this person, and that's the thing I'm deciding to get involved with.
Yeah,
which is good, because it should be a choice.
Yeah,
like it should be. I mean, I know a lot of people that this was like their childhood dream, and they're like, they know every little bit of thing about it, and then that's how they come into it. That I didn't come to it into like from that angle. I came into it like, oh man, I need a way to express myself.
Yeah.
I want to share these experiences that I've been through.
Yeah.
And I don't want it to just be this morose kind of like regurgitating of words. I want it to be like a live, present, playful way. So I chose humor. And I was like, I think this would be a fun little dichotomy, juxtaposition to go, oh, this and that, this and that. This happened, but also this happened. This happened, but also this happened. But yeah, that's how I ended up here. And then we didn't choose Brisbane. We actually ended up in Ipswich, which is... It's a bogan area, very like, it's not...
I know Ipswich.
It's Ipswich and Logan are some of the worst places in Queensland, period.
Right.
And imagine coming from a refugee camp and getting to a place and you're like, huh, I wonder why, maybe I could go back. How much was that ticket again? Because they do pay for your ticket. So like everything is taken care of.
Yeah.
They got us a house and they're like, oh, amazing. There was that house. They get you started with expenses and everything. Yeah, put your family on welfare, and then until you can sort of like start sustaining yourself.
Yeah. And how are your mum and dad going?
It was me, mum, and my three sisters.
Oh,
so
right.
Dad,
okay.
Passed in 2013.
Oh, okay.
Like a year or 2 years before we came here.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So it was just me, mum, and my three sisters.
And how's the family unit going? What's your mum doing now?
Mum just sits at home. She takes care of my little sis, Bonita.
Yep.
Who's lovely, but she has Down syndrome, so she has to be looked after. And so that's what mum does for the most part.
Right.
Angel and Joe, they are at school. Bonita's at school too. She goes to a special school. But yeah, Angel and Joe in school. One uni, one high school.
And what do they think of your stand up? Are they into it? Does it weird them out a little bit? It's always fascinating to be around parents and think of your own. Like, I think of my mum, and she must be sitting there thinking, I wipe that kid's ass. Like, what's he doing on stage, and why are these people coming to see him?
That's very funny. You know, I took mum to see me live. My sisters haven't. They saw me live at this corporate gig in Brisbane.
At a corporate gig?
Yeah. So
wow.
It was like clean, so yeah. It's good. I was like, oh, she's not going to be like, oh my God, what is he talking about? So I was like, this is as safe as it gets.
Right.
I do 20 minutes. I'm the headliner, but there's someone else, a friend of mine, Anissa, doing a 5-minute set of poetry.
Right.
And after we both finished, mom comes up to Anissa and goes, you were so fantastic. You were really, really good. Oliver, you're okay. But you were really, really good. I was like,
come on.
What do I got to do? But it's there's an element of like, I'm trying to do. So the show I have upcoming at Griffin Theatre is a play. It's in between story and like stand-up.
Yeah.
So it's that good dichotomy of drama and comedy infused together. I think that's what mum loves the most in terms of like, oh, I want to see something I'm invested in. There was a lot of jerks.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's okay. That's silly Oliver. We know silly Oliver.
Right.
So they like it.
Right.
But I feel like they're like, I want to see more.
Yeah. Well, they saw the fast food version of your career. Yes. And what they want is the three course meal.
They want the three course meal.
Yeah.
And so I think getting to a place where you can be like, oh, this is something for everybody.
Yeah.
How
was the family about you moving to Sydney?
You know what? It was just like a split decision like that. I make compulsive decisions all the time, but not like in a bad way, but like I like to take advantage of what's been given to me on the table.
Yeah.
Having lived my life not knowing what's going to happen, now I'm so very aware of like the kind of controls I could take over my life.
Right.
So in terms of like, I just, you know, the other week I was just in Melbourne and like I didn't tell anyone. I was like, I'm just going to go to Melbourne because I feel like going to Melbourne and I can afford to. And I was like, oh, yes, let's 100% do that. And in terms of coming to Sydney, I knew it would be a really good decision for my career. And I told mom and she was like, yeah, okay, if you want to do that, do that. But I know they don't travel. So I knew it was going to be a hassle in terms of like seeing them. I would have to go back. The last 3 years that I've lived in Sydney, every time I've seen them, it's because I've gone back. They've not come here.
Right.
And they most likely will not. Even the show, I'm like, I gotta take it to Queensland.
Yeah.
If I really want them to come and see it.
Perform at the Ipswich Town Hall. It's funny, I don't see really any of my family in the state either. Well, you know, like my mum and auntie and that are, you know, older, so of course that makes sense. But even a lot of my friends I don't see here. One of my dear friends, and he hadn't been to Sydney in a long time, and he came here, and he'd been here for the day, and I caught up with him, and he just had this look of terror on his face, and I was like, hey, are you all right? And he was just like, how do you live here? And it's like, oh, I guess it's quite full on, isn't it?
But it is full on.
I kind of like that electric
I love
energy.
It.
You know, as a kid,
it's so like, what else are you gonna do?
Right.
It's like, give me something.
Yes.
I'm also like, as a person, I'm like, I need, I was telling someone that every time I hear an ambulance, I get really excited.
Right.
Yeah, and I was like, oh man, somebody must have, you know, horribly shut themselves and they need an ambulance, but also super exciting.
Someone needs help and someone's
going
to.
There's something happening. You know what I mean? I get dull and just like in my head a lot if nothing is happening.
Yeah.
And I don't like being in my head. I don't know anyone that likes being in their head.
You know, it's a tough place to be sometimes. You know.
It's like my pleasure at someone else's expense.
I always wanted to live in a big city because of that. I love the sound of buses going past constantly and the exhalation of the gears, which kind of suggests to me that the city is breathing, you know. It's a comforting feeling to me, and it was always something that was a big aim, even to the extent now where I had some friends a couple of weeks ago saying, hey, when are you moving back to Melbourne? I'm like, it's just like, I like it here. I like, you know, like it's full on and it's challenging at times, but also being stuck in your own head, it's did you find lockdown challenging for that, or were you able to find ways to make sure you could get outside of your head and then go back in?
It's interesting because it's a blessing and a curse. If I find myself stuck, is like really hard to get out of, then I have to within it pull something out. When I do get out, it's that pull and push situation where it's like, yeah, then there must be a, like, I'm a very reflective kind of guy. It's like all my like work feels reflective.
Yeah.
So when I do end up in a reflective state outside my control, It's like, oh, maybe this is just an opportunity to kind of like write something or like think of something I haven't in a while and see if we can turn that into something. Yeah. So I use that lockdown in terms of like working on a few ideas that I had in my head and sharpening already odd ones that I had.
Right.
Which is good.
That sounds like a great approach, by the way. It was tricky. The thing that I found that I managed to discover about myself was that probably in the last 10 years, I'd forgotten a distinct aspect of me. And
what's that?
I had forgotten that I'm not cynical. And I know right. That's not that I thought that I was acting cynically, but there was a cynicism to my world which had
that's in vogue right now.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's you know, it comes from an ironic detachment which lends itself to a cynicism. And while I lived in Melbourne, the world that I lived in, I was constantly belittled, you know, and belittling doesn't necessarily mean in a specifically nasty way. Belittling can be in an offhand, you know, at your expense, joking around kind of way. But,
right.
But I was constantly belittled as, you know, he's the guy that likes things.
Right.
He likes, he's into things.
Right.
I know it's, and that sort of wears you down after a while. And then... And then I was here and I'm listening to every album by Roxy Music and it's like, yeah, no, I like shit. And I find that I like heaps of things and I like finding a certain amount of playfulness and joy in creation.
Yeah.
And it had stopped being that. But
are you also the kind of same person that can switch off their likeness? Can you like be around people and... Because the double-edged sword is that you're around people,
right?
And you're like, fuck, I wish I was home listening,
right?
Putting the vinyl on, and then like, is that the alternative?
Well, I reckon the pendulum swung too far.
Mm.
So there was a period actually before lockdown where there was a 6-month period up here in Sydney where I just self-isolated well before COVID was even a word that anyone had ever really sort of entertained.
Yeah.
And then I realized that, oh, I have to, you know, I have to swing it back the other way. And I think that was the right thing to do at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I had to get it back the other way. So then when I went into isolation last year, I was like, you know what? I've got this.
Right.
I've got this. I think I know how to... I'm going to have to think about this specific situation, but emotionally I know how to traverse it. But it's, you know, it's tricky. And having those times where if you are a self-reflective person, it can be, you know, it's a fine line between getting something positive out of it and just being a bit self-indulgent, right?
Yeah.
We're getting close to the end of the podcast, but I want to talk to you about your show. And I also want to talk to you about how long ago was it? Like, because time... has been stretched and compressed and it's like last year took 7 years, but we are in mid-February and it feels like it's been an hour and a half for 2021. When did I see the show that you did at the Old Giant Dwarf, the trial show?
That would have been 2019.
So that was 2019.
Yeah, end of 2019.
Far out. Like, I honestly could not work out when I saw that show. So is that the show that you're going to be doing at the theatre, or was that the genesis of the show that you're going to be doing in March, or are they two different things?
So I got to Sydney 3 years ago. I started writing two shows.
Right.
One is the one you saw, and the other is the play I'm doing at Griffin.
Right.
What's happened now is they've both been fused together.
Right.
And the Griffin show already had more details and elements of storytelling more than the show that you saw at Giant Dwarf. And that was purely a show I was going to do at festivals, or like stand-up shows. And like you were saying, that was going to be just fast food, just like mostly jokes, no real story arc or through line of like, oh, this is, you know, chronologically in this order, or this is happening, and sort of like no particular story. In this one, there is a through line. And then I've taken elements, like certain parts of like this show you saw, Ajahn Dwarf, and put that into the theater show. And then, yeah, I've made it to a point where it's like, it's a theater show. I have a set design. I have a sound design. But it's all very minimal to a point where it can be tourable in both instances. And since it's a one person show, it's just like standing up in front of people and then telling these stories and these jokes. And
it's good to have a show that's so robust that if all the tech stops working, everyone can hold up their phones, put the light on you, and you can still do the show.
Yeah.
And then everything else is is flavor.
Yes. So there's that show you saw. It's not too far away from the show I'm doing at Griffin in terms of themes. It just has more layers. There's more layers and more layers and more layers, more flavors, just a more deep, dense dish that you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, especially for your mum. This will be the show your mum loves.
Yes.
And can you give us a synopsis of what this show entails?
A synopsis of the show. So it's called Jali, and Jali is a West African term, which means a storyteller, a poet, a musician, like a historian. And back in the days, the oral tradition of storytelling within Africa was you'd have, say, a chief of the village, and that chief would have his second-hand man, and that man would go around the village telling stories and like giving people the information that the chief would want to pass through the whole village. So it would be like this ceremonial thing where he would come, maybe set a bone, like a fire in the middle, and then play some music, tell some stories, and then give some information and all that and all that. And then stories, he would go from village to village, from village to village. And like what was a Jali back then would be a modern day stand-up comedian or a storyteller.
Right.
Like a Dave Chappelle, like a Chris Rock. Those, they emulate like very, very specific skills and elements of Jalis and griots. Sometimes they're called griot.
Right.
So the show entails the genesis of how I ended up to Australia. So it weaves through this pendulum of time going, we're in Rwanda, we're in Malawi, in Australia. How did we end up here? How have times changed? It's a very, it's a show about change and how experiences changes someone.
Yep.
And how one adapts to that. So one of the quotes that I use in the show is, when the music changes, so does the dance.
Right.
And it's an old African proverb that it really encapsulates change in the perfect sense as possible. Is that, you know, you hear a song, this is the dance we're dancing now, but if it changes, you do change the dance. And that element of adapting is it's like a symbol of motivation, of resilience within the African community. And I've tried to carry that on with every kind of like changing moment. Even last year when everything drastically changed, you kind of like remember these elements of like, okay, this is a different song, so let's dance differently.
Great. And is this the debut of it, or did you get to perform it before?
No, this is the debut of it.
Great.
It was scheduled for last year,
right? That's what I thought. Yeah.
And then COVID came, and I was like, well, and then the contract got scrapped, and then it got recontracted, luckily enough, because a lot of moving pieces, like everyone else in a lot of theater companies at Griffin, but they were super supportive enough and super excited to bring it back. So I'm very lucky to having to do it finally.
Yeah.
So I'm doing 2 weeks of a run. It was 1 week last year. So
that's good.
Shows this year. Yeah.
2 weeks is good.
Yeah, Twitch is good.
Gives you time to lean into it.
Yeah,
and, you know,
really get to it, and more people to see it.
Yeah,
here before I can tour it around.
And any chance that it's going to be touring?
Yes, That's the goal. But it's also like a very deeply personal show with like all these dense layers.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how much can it take out of me before I'm like, I'm like, okay, I think that's enough, people.
When I would work with young comics who wanted to do something that was deeply personal and maybe had a level of trauma in their story. And when I would work with people, I would always say, you know, the Melbourne Comedy Festival goes 3.5 weeks.
Yeah.
We need to make this show bulletproof for the middle of the festival. That Wednesday, that's right, like 14 days in, 15 days in, when the joy of starting has worn off and the light at the end of the tunnel is still a long way away.
Yeah.
And audiences are tired and you're tired and you've been calling on this every day. And if we can make the show survive that, then the show is ready to go.
Yeah.
But the other way to go is do it for 2 weeks. Don't worry about that middle.
Don't worry about that middle bit.
That's the thing that I like. One of the many things I find fascinating and admirable and inspiring about Hannah Gadsby's show.
Yeah.
Is that she's done that. Well, she did that for a long time all over the world. And That is full on to call on that.
That's
call
intense.
On that moment. Oh,
and that's intense.
To continue to flourish and grow is.
But it's also like, I don't imagine. I've done this thing where I've like, oh, this is my whole story, kind of put into a show, and I'm happy that I'm doing it now. Not that I was like any different, but I was like a year younger last year. But it's funny, I'm a kind of person that can learn a lot in a short time, so I've learned so much about like myself. I was like, oh, I really want to do this show everywhere, but I was like, yeah, it's gonna take an emotional toll, and it is my story as much as it is mom's and my three sisters and dad that are all involved within this story. So there's a limitation to how much I can go before it starts feeling a little bit like I'm using someone else's story to kind of like further myself. But
it's also the responsibility is inherent, but you also want to share that story.
Yeah.
So I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you will nail it. Like, because you've thought about it. Like, if you hadn't thought about it, then I'd be like, how's your mum feel about this? But because you've thought about it, that implies that it'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be good. But yeah, I can't imagine touring that show. It's also like, in my head, I'm like, because of the technical elements of the show, it's like, I want to do it. It's good because then the only place that I can genuinely do it that translates the same level of intimacy is in small venues.
Yep.
So that's good.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm hoping it's a big hit. So I hope that you have some issues in trying to work out how to make
how
it bigger.
To make it bigger.
That's a, you know, that would be a good problem to have.
It would be.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. You'll have
Thank
to come
you
back.
Me, man.
Where can people find tickets for your show and where can they find you on social media?
They can find tickets on the show at twisted.pro, which is a website of mine.
Yep.
And then that would directly take them to Griffin Theatre, or they can go to Griffin Theatre in Darlinghurst, Stables Theatre, and be like, hi, I would like a ticket to Jali, which is the next show at Griffin Theatre. So right now, Green Park is on.
Yep.
And the next one is Jali, and that runs from the 16th to the 27th of March.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And you're on Twitter and...
I'm on Instagram, which is the only platform I'm on.
And
but
just
I'm
your
barely
name?
Yeah, Oliver E. Twist.
Right.
Yeah, middle name in there. So. But I feel, and I don't know about this, I feel like sometimes to actually, you know, make something, you gotta go away from it a little bit.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So I get torn between like, and not that there's a whole lot happening on my Instagram, by the way, but it's like you can lose yourself in the scrolling and the catching up, and it's like, oh, I haven't done any productive work of mine.
Oh, absolutely. Look at that massive tome of a book over there by Ryan Hughes. I keep that right next to my desk when I'm working. So then that way, because you're right, it's easy to just go, oh, I'll just have a look. Oh, my God, I've lost an hour. You know what's better? Pick that up, read for 15 minutes, and then go back to your work. So smart move on your behalf. thank you once again for being on the show. And while I think of it, great work at the Comedy Store on the weekend.
Oh, thank you.
Really, really funny sets and really interesting. And I thought you were a standout over the three shows over the weekend. So,
thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Good luck for the show. And I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, can't wait for people to see it. Thank you.
Thank you to Oliver and Roe for being a part of the podcast. Remember to head to our Big Squid with Justin Hamilton Facebook page, where you will be able to find tickets to his one-person show at the Griffin Theatre. Thank you for all the kind words and feedback in the past week. It is always great to hear from you, and it really does inspire me to try and make this podcast the most entertaining part of your week. I don't know if it gets there, but that is the aim. I'll be back later this week with our next episode of The Leftovers. I'm really enjoying that as well. It's nice to have some one-on-one time with you. Enough of these pesky guests getting in the way of us hanging out, right? I've also made a concerted effort to not talk about Christopher Nolan this season. I feel like I've only dropped his name maybe 7 or 8 times per podcast. But if you'd like to hear me bang on some more about it, go over and check out the latest episode of FOFOP with Will Anderson. Yes, he finally saw Tenet. I knew Will was going to love Tenet, but look, I had to suppress all compulsions to tell him this because it took him ages, like fucking ages. I started to take it personally. Like, I was like, you're deliberately not seeing this even though you know you're going to love it just to spite me. Yeah, that's where I got in my head. No, that's not true. But I did have to suppress the compulsion to just... I didn't even want to tell him, hey, you're going to love this, because even that could put a little dent in the enjoyment. So anyway, he finally saw it. Guess what? Loved it. And we talk about it on the podcast. It's a fun podcast. Head over to the TOFOP website to find that. It's episode 318 of FOFOP. Over at my website, justinhamilton.com.au, you can find blogs and short stories to keep you entertained when you should be working or doing the dishes or anything really useful in the world. We'll have more details about the live show soon too, so keep an ear out for that. And as always, come over to our Facebook page and say hello. If you get the time, if you get the opportunity. And if you have time to post a positive review on any of the sites that you use, or would like to encourage people to listen to this podcast, then that would be greatly appreciated. Let's go out today with a quote from Susan Sontag. I feel once again and I rejoice that I'm not busy dying, I'm still busy being born. Until then.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.